Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Fintan O'Toole had a front row seat as Ireland boomed as the Celtic Tiger. Now he and all of Ireland are sifting through the wreckage of that boom, and Fintan O'Toole is angry. There's a trail of corruption here, he says. Reckless policy, a gouged public, and a lost moral compass. Fintan O'Toole is looking for the lessons. We'll hear him out. This hour on Point St. Patrick weeps. We'll look at what sank the Celtic Tiger. You can join the conversation. Did you see Ireland when its economy was on fire in the boom, when people were emigrating to Ireland? And what do you see now in the ashes, in the aftermath, with a little thanks to the chieftains there? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Dublin is Fintan O'Toole, columnist and critic for the Irish Times. His new book is Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. Publishers Weekly calls it a deeply shocking account of what went wrong. Fintan O'Toole, welcome. It's great to have you at last. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. It's lovely to be here.
So we all kind of saw the story from afar. Many of us may have seen it up close. You were right in the thick of it. Remind us, before we get to the bust, just how big and unusual for Ireland the boom was. What's the boom you're talking about? Give us a sense of it, Fintan.
Yeah, well, I suppose most of your listeners will be aware that the Irish story is historically a relatively grim one. You know, we didn't have the best of luck throughout most of history. And even in the 20th century, you know, after Irish independence, between 1922 when Ireland became independent and around 1992, so the first 70 years, I mean, Ireland was outstandingly underdeveloped, really, by the standards of a Western European economy. You know, when I started writing in the Irish Times in the late 1980s, we had two-thirds of the average income of the European Union, even though we'd been members of the European Union for quite a long time. Even in the early 1990s, we still had three-quarters of the wealth of the rest of the European Union. So, you know, things in Ireland were not good. And as you mentioned, you know, the automatic assumption of a lot of Irish people growing up was that they wouldn't be able to make a living in their own country. And, you know,
Ireland
has historically been been this kind of nursery of migrants. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that started to reverse in the 1990s. So you began to get fairly slowly at first, but then very rapidly gathering pace. You got huge investment coming into Ireland, principally from American-based multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. You got rising wealth. You got rising standards of living. And what had been a sort of vicious circle with emigration, you know, whereby the place was poor, so people emigrated, so it got poorer, that turned into a virtuous circle. So the more money came into the place, you not only did you stop people emigrating, but you started getting very smart, very experienced, very skilled Irish people coming back from the States, from Britain, from the rest of Europe, coming into the economy. And really, for about 7 years or so, it was a really remarkable period. I mean, just to put this, you know, in context, I mean, the workforce in Ireland doubled over that period. So we really went from, it's a very small place to remind people, it's only got about 4.5 million people. So we went from having about 1 million people at work to having 2 million people at work.
That's huge.
It's enormous, you know. And we went from, of course, from outward migration to a situation in the early part of the century where you got 10% of everybody living in Ireland was born outside the country. And a lot of these were people coming from Central and Eastern Europe, even from Africa. Now, the idea for somebody, I'm 52, the idea of somebody of my age, of, you know, people coming to Ireland to look for work is like, you know, going to the Sahara for the skiing. You know,
yes.
it just made no sense whatsoever. And this was an absolutely marvelous period. And of course, it was also feeding into that and partly shaped by it was the Northern Ireland peace process as well.
Of course.
So, you had just an enormous air of optimism, a great sense of opportunity. And for a lot of us, it really seemed like, you know, all that dark history was really behind us now, you know, that economically, in terms of the conflict, but also psychologically, in terms of our optimism, things really had changed. Absolutely. So people like my kids now, who are in their early 20s, you know, they grew up in a place that was very, very forward-looking and very exciting, and where they kind of assumed that they certainly would never have to go abroad to work. If they might go abroad if they chose to do so, but that it would never be forced on them.
And the signs of affluence, the signs of Ireland's boom, they were everywhere. I mean, you open your book, Ship of Fools, with a wonderful, very colourful example, just one of many, no doubt. But give us a sense of just how deep the froth was when it was deep.
Well, this is part of the problem, I suppose, is that when you haven't had money in a society historically, I suppose it's inevitable that some of the money you get is going to be used for absolutely ostentatious display. And there was a vulgarity to the way in which the newly wealthy spent their money and showed it off. I think the thing I opened the book with is just talking about this a wedding of a major property developer, a guy called Sean Dunn, you know, but his wedding was on what had been Aristotle Onassis's yacht, his private yacht, Christina
O. Yeah, of course.
And, you know, this sort of very, very ostentatious idea of you know, that you couldn't just get married. You know, you had to get married on Aristotle Onassis's yacht. You had to sort of have a cruise around the Mediterranean.
And of course, a 40-day cruise with all of his friends after a wedding at a 17th-century villa in the Italian Riviera, and on we go.
Absolutely. And you know, that wasn't untypical. I mean, it's an extreme version of it. But in a way, you know, what happened in Ireland was a kind of classic consumer boom. So it started out really with people working very hard, with workers getting more productive, with Ireland exporting a lot around the world. I mean, Ireland became the biggest exporter of software in the world, for example, over this period. So, you know, there was a real economic base to it. But then it rapidly became a sense of being rich. People started feeling that they were rich. And when they start feeling they're rich, they start behaving as if they're rich, even if they're not. So what you would have seen, I'm sure any of your listeners who came to Ireland in that period would have seen frantic amounts of building. There were, you know, cranes on the skyline all the time. They also would have seen people, you know, buying the most expensive things they possibly could. A lot of very, very expensive cars on the road. They would have seen a lot of new shopping malls going up. And they would have found that prices in Ireland were incredibly expensive. I think it was a real shock for a lot of Americans coming to Ireland, you know, who might have been used to going 10 years before. You know, you were
scoop up some nice bargains on sweaters and suddenly,
yeah. I mean, suddenly it was costing you, you know, the price of a small farm in Montana, you know, to just to stay overnight in a hotel.
And
know,
housing was absolutely through the roof in Ireland.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the real sort of economic problem, actually. You know, I mean, some of the self-indulgence you can kind of understand, because I said, you know, you've been poor a long time, and it's probably inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And the Irish are not exactly behind the door when it comes to partying in bad times, so it wasn't likely that they were going to stop partying in good times. So the real problem, though, was to do with housing and was to do with land. And part of the point I'm trying to make in the book is one of the weird things that happens, you know, is that you've got in Ireland at this time, so by the beginning of the 21st century, Ireland has become the cutting edge of economic globalization. You know, there's
free markets, global trade, wide
absolutely
open.
high technology, you know, all the Viagra in the world is being made in Ireland.
Cork, a real poster child for that whole view of the world and how the
completely
economy should work, you know.
Completely. And in a way, this is sort of the problem, you know, that really what happened, or at least what I would argue happened, is that it's almost a conceptual problem about globalization. That, you know, what happened in Ireland happened because, as all these things always are, inevitably very, very complex. You know, there were a lot of different factors that fed into it. And instead of actually then beginning to try to understand what had happened and therefore how you could keep this prosperity going in a sustainable way over a long period of time, what happened was we bought into a version of Ireland which was also imported. So just as we were importing all these great American companies, we also started importing a particular American version of what was happening in Ireland. And this American version was one that was really kind of favored by neoconservatives. You know, American neoconservatives in particular. You know, there was a very particular way of looking at Ireland, which was not to do with Ireland really, and was really to do with American politics in a way. It was to do with kind of an internal American argument. And this culminated, people might remember, with say John McCain in the debates against Obama citing Ireland and saying, you know, if America was more like Ireland, we'd be doing very well. This wasn't great timing because Ireland was already falling apart at that point. But it culminated, was the culmination of a process really whereby a lot of the right wing in America had been looking at Ireland and saying, look, what's happened in in Ireland. It's a miracle. How has it happened? It's happened because of two things. It's happened because the Irish have cut taxes and they've had very, very light regulation. Mm. And this then was used as kind of empirical evidence that what globalization is about is cutting taxes and having light regulation. And mm-hmm. if you do both of those things, it's a formula. It's like you've found the magic lamp. You just keep rubbing the lamp and the genie will come out.
And you can be as successful as Ireland.
As Ireland. Now, and in a way, that was kind of fine. And it was very flattering if you were Irish. And it was very nice to hear people saying good things about us. And it was kind of a bit of fun for a while to be pointed out around the world as being the good boys in the class.
Of course.
Because it was kind of different from the way we'd been seen for a long time. But the problem was that we started to believe it ourselves. And Irish government started to believe it. And they sort of bought into this ideological view of what had happened. And so they said, well, OK, well, this is the formula. We know the formula. All we have to do is we just keep cutting taxes. And make sure that there's very, very light regulation. You know, you get a lot of euphemisms about business-friendly environments and all that, but it basically meant that particularly in the financial sector, you really weren't going to regulate. And that did attract a lot of companies in, and the low taxation did attract a lot of companies in. But it's a very simplistic formula, and it's a very poor way, I think, of understanding how globalization works and how particularly smaller open societies have to interact with it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ireland and the lessons of its epic boom, now turned to bust. Fintan O'Toole is with us from Dublin. His new book is Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. We're sorry for that theme on St. Patrick's Day, but there were the good times, and now there are the rough times. A lot of it went all the way back to the Good Friday Agreement, April 10th, 1998, when peace suddenly loomed, very big and in a welcome way on the horizon. Here's then-Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern hailing the new accord. This is April 1998, hailing it as a new beginning for Ireland.
It's a day we should treasure, a day when agreement and accommodation have taken the place of difference and division. And today is about the promise of a bright future, a day when we hope a line can be drawn under the bloody past. We must all seize the opportunity. Ahead of us stretches the prospect of a radical transformation of all the key relationships on these islands.
We must seize the opportunity, said Prime Minister Bertie Ahern then, 1998, and there were many, many opportunities seized in the decade and more that followed. Fintan O'Toole has written about them. It's a polemic. It's a book full of anger about what happened with Ireland, but it sure was fun while it lasted. And Fintan, here's a web comment from our website from Bob, who says, we went back to Ireland in April 2006 after last being there in 1973. The first morning we were there, we had breakfast in the B&B. The radio show there in Ireland was on about buying property in Romania. We could not figure out what was going on. Now we know, says Bob. Yeah.
It says it all, doesn't it? You know, yeah. And I'm afraid that's not untypical. You know, you see, what happened was something kind of like, you know, historians talk about the South Sea bubble, or they talk about the great tulip mania in
yes.
Holland, you know, where
mm-hmm.
people started spending fortunes on the new tulip. And it was something like that. I mean, it actually did get to that point in terms of property. And this is, I mean, if it weren't so sort of tragic, it would be sort of fascinating, because if you think about it, right, I mean, Ireland's new wealth is all based on technology. It's mm-hmm. all based on international connectedness. It's you know, really at the cutting edge of all that stuff.
And we all said, bravo, it looked so great. Who didn't, you know, think great for Ireland? It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, and there was huge, you're absolutely right, Tom. You know, there was fantastic international goodwill towards Ireland mm-hmm. in relation to all of this. And Ireland's image actually helped to attract a lot of the investment. So mm-hmm. so these things kind of worked together, I think. But the strange thing is, when you think about a society that, you know, is now at the cutting edge, what does it become obsessed with? It becomes obsessed with the same thing it would have been obsessed with in the 19th century or the 18th century, which is land, property. Mm-hmm. So you'll get an almost feudal sense that really, you know, what do you do with your money? And you do with your money in Ireland exactly what, say, a gentleman in the early Industrial Revolution in England would have wanted to do. He would have wanted to buy an estate, you know. And people in Ireland became obsessed with buying property. The big sort of indigenous elite that emerged wasn't people who were working in the computer industries, wasn't people who were working in pharmaceuticals, wasn't people who were at the cutting edge of technology. It was people who were property developers. So most of the sort of really important, clued in, politically connected class in Ireland were people who were buying up property in Ireland, developing property in Ireland, but then also in England, in America, and all around the world. And so you got this kind of elite version of that, which required these guys to borrow increasingly large sums of money from Irish banks for speculative property development. And then you got the sort of ordinary version of it, which was ordinary people, when they got a bit of money, put that money into taking out larger and larger and larger mortgages to buy houses that were clearly not and were never going to be worth what they were paying for them.
This will sound very familiar to millions of Americans these days. It's not as though the US is in a position to throw stones. On the contrary, but the Irish version of the story is a very interesting one. You've got a kind of a summary of the good times later on in the book, Fintan. I wonder if you could read for us, just to take us in. You've got a wonderful description here of a country morphing and evolving in a very special moment. We'll look at the, as you call it, the tragedy that followed, but I wonder if you could read a bit for us right there in at the top of your epilogue.
Sure, this just gives you some sense, I suppose, of what I think about those good years. It was fun while it lasted. For about 6 years, from the mid-1990s until late 2001, Ireland felt free at last. Free from the pain and bitterness of forced emigration. Free from the sense of inferiority that comes with a long history of failure and the exaggerated defence of national self-regard that always accompanies and shadows that emotion. Free from the hopeless feeling of being locked into an insoluble ethnic and sectarian conflict. Free from the authoritarian religiosity that compensated for the absence of civic morality. Free from the need to celebrate picturesque poverty as a way of making a virtue of grim necessity. In those years, Ireland was raw and sometimes vulgar. It was poorly led and hampered by a lack of long-term vision and genuine public ambition. It was chaotic, sometimes to the point of anarchy. But there was the ultimate ground for optimism. It was obvious that things could change for the better, because they were in the course of doing so. People who had been unemployed were now working. People who had been forced to live in the US or the UK were coming home. Long derelict sites were being filled, if not with fine buildings, then at least with something other than weeds and litter. Change wasn't just in the air, it was visible and tangible. This was a tonic for a culture that had been steeped in fatalism. Some of the attractive sides of Irish life had been underpinned by that fatalism, the idea that things will probably be terrible in the long run, that there's nothing much we can do about it, and that we might as well have a good time while we're waiting. But for a while, it seemed that the Irish could have a good time without expecting the worst to arrive eventually. There was an exuberance to Irish life, but one which seemed to be compatible with hard work and ambition. The strengths that had always been brought to bear by the Irish in exile, resourcefulness, adaptability, energy, seemed finally to have found their place at home.
Fintan O'Toole reading from his new book, Ship of Fools. And when things were good, they were very, very good, or certainly felt that way. We've talked a lot about the good times. I think that still is imprinted on people's minds. The image of Ireland celebrating and on the rise was so kind of startling and welcome. Describe the fall for us, Fintan, and what it has meant, what Ireland's situation is today.
So, yeah, I mean, the fall in Ireland, people in America use this phrase about the look of the Irish, and I've never really understood it, you know, because what happened to us was a mixture of really two falls, if you like, two crashes. I mean, one is that we were engaged ourselves in an unsustainable process. So really from certainly the beginning of the 21st century onwards, we were increasingly inflating this extraordinary property bubble. And we were really living off borrowed money to a very large extent. And that was going to be unsustainable and it was going to crash. And it began to unravel in 2007, again, slowly at first and then quickly. And then, of course, the second crash was the international crash, was the credit crunch, Lehman Brothers, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Our bad luck is that both of these kind of hit us at the same time. And the effects of this are really pretty stark, because it's sort of like going over a cliff. we were collectively, I mean, not all of us, I mean, some of us were trying to say these things, but collectively as a society, we were pretty much in denial about the fact that a lot of what we were doing was unsustainable. So for most people, this really came as a terrible shock. And the effect of it is that, well, first of all, I suppose the most obvious tangible thing is, you know, very large numbers of people have lost their jobs. We've gone from having about 3 or 4% unemployment, we're heading up towards maybe 15%. You've started to see emigration starting up again. And I suppose the most tangible, and to me at least the most sickening image really of it, you know, is the empty house. A lot of people of Irish extraction or even people who visited Ireland or moved around the place will be haunted by the image in Ireland of the empty house. It was the image of famine, it was the image of mass emigration, it was the image of the depopulation of an entire society. And it's a very powerfully imprinted image for Irish people.
Not to mention what you're up against looking at the future. If I read you right, the IMF, at least at one point, was predicting that Ireland's GDP would shrink by 13.5% last year and this year, shrink that much, that Ireland's gross indebtedness, is this possible? Its gross indebtedness is larger than Japan's? Is that?
It's larger than Japan's.
That's mind-boggling. Yeah,
it is mind-boggling, you know, because
Japan's so much larger. It's the second largest economy, I think, still in the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And you're talking about, and again, I suppose to remind people of the context, you're talking about a society of 4.5 million people. You know, the gross indebtedness in Ireland at this point, I mean, the amount of money owed by Irish businesses and corporations and everything resident in Ireland is about $1.2-1.3 trillion. You know, that's a hell of a lot of money. And, you know, it's not going to be easy to get over that, you know. And then if you look at even things like property, for example, I mean, I was saying about that image of the empty house. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got about 300,000 empty houses now.
Wow.
And these are empty houses that we manufactured in the good times. So we're
in a country of only 4 million souls in total.
So that's, you know, it's about 17% of the entire housing stock is empty. You know, and that's a real sign of just the kind of hysterical, crazy sort of building boom that was going on. So physically, tangibly, you know, you can see this around you. And I think for the majority of the population, you know, there's a deep sense of anger. There's a deep sense of disillusionment. You know, people feel that they've been very badly let down by government, by the banks, by property developers, even by the media. You know, I'm in that business myself, but, you know, a lot of people feel, well, why weren't you guys telling us more about the reality behind this while it was going on? Again, some of us were, but it's probably true to say that, you know, a lot of people contributed to this sort of self-delusion.
Oh, well, Americans know well what it feels like to be in that bubble, and nobody really wants to question. Here's a little tape from Ireland's RTE channel. This is back in June 06, talking about the skyrocketing housing prices then.
House prices here have increased by 270% over the past 10 years, according to the results of a survey published today. The permanent TSB ESRI House Price Index said that the average annual increase in prices was almost 15% for each year since 1996.
15% a year for a decade. But it did not, maybe could not, last. We've got a lot of response to Fintan. Fintan O'Toole's new book is Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. Here's a web comment from Rafe Ogini, or Ogini, I'm not sure, Rafe, but it says, what is to be mourned is the loss of our, I guess he means the Irish, our soul. Instead of the riches wooing us back to the spirit of the golden ages, when we were known for all that's great about the human mind and spirit, we became a superficial people. He writes, how can we take the present sad state and use it to reclaim what it means to be Irish? From a web commenter there. And let's get our callers in as well. Bob in Boston, you're on the air with Fintan O'Toole, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Fintan.
Hello. Hi, Bob.
I just turned the radio on. I'm looking forward to getting your book. But I grew up in Dublin, and I lived here for 15, 20 years in the Boston area. And then I moved back for the Celtic Tiger. And what was really interesting was that I knew I had changed, but when I got to Ireland, I was just shocked at how Ireland had changed. The people, you know, the people just were so arrogant at that point, you know, 2006, 2007. It was really disappointing to me as a person that grew up there. You know, I grew up in the bad times, but we always got along. We always had fun, but it was just really shocking.
In what way, Bob? What was the problem that you saw?
Well, the problem was with all the money that people had, you know, people had a lot of money, and the elite had the most money, obviously, and they still do, but it was even the average guy, you know, refinancing their house, they really had this air of aristocracy about them that was really sickening to me. And, you know, I bought into it, too. I bought a house. I got jobs. But, you know, after 2 years, I really had to, I gave it up. I mean, I just, like, it's still the same island. At the bottom, at the end of the day, it was still the same island. People weren't getting paid a ton of money for doing the jobs that they were doing. And that's what it came down to. The taxes were still fairly high.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it didn't really make sense to me. So I moved away again.
So you're out again. And, Bob, I appreciate your call. Fintan, you write a lot about changes in character that you saw, as Bob did on his return there.
Yeah, I'd like to say that Bob was wrong, but he's not. You know, there was a sense that, I suppose you have to put it in some kind of context, right? That you know, Irish identity, you know, is a very fluid thing. And it was an identity that had been rooted in Catholicism for the majority of people. It had also been rooted in kind of, you know, a very strong sense of nationality. I mean, those things were obviously changing very rapidly over this whole period. So you could say, well, okay, a lot of the landmarks that people had by which they located themselves were shifting throughout this whole period. And part of what happens then, you know, when you get all this money coming in, is that the money replaces that old sense of identity. So you begin to think of yourself as being defined by what you've got rather than by who you are. And that definitely happened to us. And again, this is not unique. I know it's, you know, it's happened in a lot of other societies, but it was kind of sad in Ireland, I suppose, because we had a particularly strong sense of our own identity, which had something of a richness to it. It had an imagination and perhaps an artistic side to it. And we did start to think of ourselves really as being, you know, we listened to all this stuff about people telling us how wonderful we were and how much we were the poster child for globalization, and we did start to believe it, and we did start to swagger a bit. And I think, however, the web comments that was also leading into that is a very interesting one, which is, it kind of relates to it, which is, if that's true, I think that it is also true, and, you know, not to be entirely depressive on St. Patrick's Day, that actually the shock to the system that's come now actually does really demand that people think again about, you know, what does it mean to be an Irish person? What kind of society do they want? What sort of values really would be tied up in that notion of being Irish? And it's really interesting, you know, that so many of the institutions have failed people. The church is going through its own terrible crisis over child abuse. Mm-hmm. The politicians really don't have a lot of public trust anymore. The banks obviously are nobody's idea of heroes. So, you know, there's a general lack of trust and lack of faith in the institutions, but that forces people back on to, you know, to values, to ideas about, you know, what are the good sides of being Irish. And it was very interesting today, the event in the White House, you know, which typically where you get a lot of Irish politicians and business people going to the White House.
This is the Prime Minister Brian Cowen there with
you get all that every year. Mm-hmm. But it's been very interesting this year that actually, and I don't know how much this is to do with the Obamas or the invitations, but disproportionately the people who've been invited, who were invited to the White House were artists.
And not businessmen, not just
not,
now.
Not business people. And one of the things we're actually realizing is, you know, okay, well, who hasn't let us down in Ireland? And actually, you know, if you look at it as a group, one of the very few sets of people who haven't let people down are the writers, the musicians, the singers, the actors, the playwrights. You know, we still have an incredibly vibrant artistic community. And in that art is something that people were talking about in terms of the Irish soul or whatever it is. But if you want to find it, you know, you certainly find it much more in artistic creativity than you find it in a lot of the political expression. And I think people are beginning to look again to the artistic life and the artistic imagination as a way of trying to define something about what could be good about being Irish.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour on this St. Patrick's Day about Ireland and the lessons of its epic boom, now turned to bust. Fintan O'Toole joins us from Dublin. He's a columnist and a critic with the Irish Times, written a really sharp new book called Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. Fintan, what about that? There are parts of your book where I was thinking, oh boy, if this author wasn't Irish, people would really go after him almost for being anti-Irish. You're saying that Ireland skipped modernity, that it's not handling modern democracy well, that it doesn't have civic morality. Give us your read.
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing I should say is that the anger in the book, you know, is absolutely not Irish. It's the contrary. You know, I think I'm just so angry that the opportunities my country had to really create a great, great sustainable society here. Mm. I mean, we really had that chance, and I'm really angry that we haven't done it. I think a lot of Irish people are. Mm. But I suppose the critique I've made it is pretty upfront, and it argues, I suppose, quite directly that one of our big problems in Ireland over the boom time was moral. And morality is a kind of unfashionable thing to talk about in terms of politics and economics. But actually, morality matters a hell of a lot. It matters to the way in which businesses conduct themselves, the way in which banks conduct themselves, the way in which choices get made that actually have very severe economic consequences. And this really relates to the nature of our political system, I think. A lot of people listening may say, well, I don't know anything about Irish politics and I don't want to know very much about Irish politics. Well, if you live in Boston or you live in Chicago or you live in New York, you know a lot about Irish politics, actually, because the Irish created the great political machines. You know, that's one of the things we gave the world for good or ill. We were very good at doing that kind of politics for historical reasons. The problem is in the States, the sort of Irish machine politics actually did acquire quite a progressive force over time, because there were forces in American society that forced it to change and open up and develop. In Ireland, really, what happened is we sort of retained this sort of 19th century machine politics. And that's still very much what we have. And what happens with machine politics is that the machine doesn't have a soul. You know, it actually doesn't really care about ideas. It doesn't care about the long term. It doesn't care about values. It cares about holding power. So that was really what our political culture has been very much centered on. And when you've got a machine political culture, it tends towards corruption. And it tends towards corruption because the big issue then is who's connected and who's not connected. Mm. Now, I've never argued, and I want to make this clear, Ireland is not a corrupt society any more than the vast majority of Western democracies. And actually, at all sorts of ordinary levels, it's a very good place to do business. It's a very good place to live. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are very honest and decent. But in terms of the connection between business and politics, I think there has been a fundamental corruption. And that corruption is really rooted in one word, which is impunity. In a lot of societies, there's corruption, but the rule is if you get caught, you go to jail. Because Ireland is very small, because its politics has been rooted in this kind of machine attitude, one of the distinctive things is that people who get caught don't pay a price. And I tried to chart this in the book, really, as to how it became impossible for someone who was a regulator, for example. I mean, take this down to brass tacks. You know, if you're a regulator looking at the banking system, you knew that many of the people in the banking system were very closely connected with senior politicians. You knew that when they were breaking the law and when they were, you know, organizing tax evasion, or they were, you know, engaged in all sorts of hair-raising stuff, that for you to raise your head above the parapet and try to call them out on it, the only person that was likely to get blamed was you. And that even if somebody was found guilty of doing something, the chances were that they wouldn't go to jail. There wouldn't be any real accountability.
But was this more true for Ireland than elsewhere? You've just been in the States, and I'm sure a lot of Americans hearing you speak along these lines must have said, well, welcome to the club. I mean, we've got our own sort of shocking closeness between politicians and high bankers and revolving doors in this country. Ireland surely wasn't alone in that.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying it was alone, but I do think it was extreme. And I think it becomes extreme in a small society. I mean, one of the differences is, you know, that at least some of your guys will go to jail. You will at least go through the ritual. And you may say it's hypocritical and you may say it's only kind of it picks on certain individuals. But even that does have actually quite an important function in a society, because it actually at least upholds the idea that there's some moral standard. Even if that moral standard is being broken, it sort of says to people, well, you know, we're going to make an example of a couple of these guys who get caught, and they're going to go to jail, they're going to do the perp walk, they're going to be on TV, and they will be labelled as criminals.
I think a lot of Americans are still waiting for a little more of that footage, but point taken.
Well, you're a lot more likely to get it than we are, I think, and this is the problem. Now, the difficulty, I suppose, really what I'm arguing is that and this again is, I suppose, it's linked to the very, very strong sense that the church in Ireland defines people's identity for the majority of people in the Republic of Ireland, you know, 98% Catholic society when I was growing up.
But you're right about the collapse of the church in Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. So really what we got in the Celtic Tiger years was we got we got, first of all, the legacy of church domination, which was that we outsourced our morality, you know, so the church told us what was right and wrong. And if the church didn't say it was wrong, then it couldn't be wrong. Now, the church, unfortunately, I think the institutional church, I'm not talking about, you know, the vast majority of Catholics, but the institutional church really obsessed about sex and obsessed about, you know, morality in sexual terms. You know, it was much more concerned with homosexuality, for example, than with tax evasion. You know, tax evasion wasn't a crime, homosexuality was.
Right.
And I think I used the line in the book that it was okay to be bent so long as you were straight, you know, so long as you were sexually behaving yourself.
So
you know,
okay to be corrupt, in other words.
Yes. I mean, bent is the word we use for corrupt, yeah.
Yes.
You know, but, you know, that sort of idea that morality was only about sex actually had quite a damaging effect in terms of people thinking about morality on a much broader level. But then what happened was that even that sense of a moral code which was there really began to collapse in the 1980s, early 1990s, as the church itself ran into huge institutional difficulties, which it's still struggling with. So what you get is a kind of moral vacuum. And I think that has really severe economic consequences. And one of the reasons why the Irish story is sort of interesting beyond Ireland, I think, is that it draws attention to the way in which issues like morality, issues like culture, issues like the way you do your politics are economic issues. You know, I think part of the problem with the way in which we've conceptualized globalization, we've conceptualized economics, is that we've seen them in very, very narrow terms. And I think a lot of what we're learning now is that if you only see economics as being about money, then you actually don't understand economics. Economics is about a whole set of relationships, and morality is one of them. You know, if people don't have a clear sense of right and wrong, then they're going to become reckless, and that recklessness will have severe economic consequences.
Amen. Here's some pushback from the web, Fintan. Here's Janet, who says, Ireland was an economic disaster for decades because of overregulation and socialism, she says. At least the last decade they had some growth and jobs. What do you say?
Well, we never had any socialism in Ireland.
It's thrown around very easily in the US these days.
I mean, Ireland, just as a matter of fact, I mean, Ireland has been ruled for all of its existence, I mean, literally all of its existence, by centre-right parties. So it's, you know, the political culture in Ireland is the least left-wing in Europe. So even before the Celtic Tiger, you know, we didn't have a left-wing political culture. And in terms of over-regulation, I just don't think that's true. You know, that the lesson we've learned is that, you know, of course you can have bureaucracy and you can have over bureaucracy and you can have a strangling of entrepreneurial effort and all of that stuff and red tape. And, you know, I'm not arguing for any of that. But there has to be a sense of regulation. And actually, funny enough, people often say to me, well, Ireland's a very small place. Why do you need a lot of regulation? Actually, the smaller the place, the more regulation you need, because the more the people who are involved in banks, for example, know each other, the more guys are moving from being the regulator one day to being on the board of the bank the next day. You know, the intimacy of the culture actually means that it's really important that you've got objective regulators with a lot of teeth. What we had in Ireland was, really, because we were attracting in an awful lot of foreign banks. And this affects American people, by the way, because a huge number of the banks that were coming into Dublin, for example, as a financial services centre, were the treasury management arms of major American corporations. And they were being attracted to Ireland because they could set themselves up as Irish entities and they could pay tax at Irish rates rather than paying them at American rates. You know, now that's kind of, you know, you lost out on that and we gained on it. But in the long term, it's very difficult to sustain that. If really what you're attracting these companies in with is saying, look, you're going to have very low taxes, but you're also going to have really no regulation, that means that you're establishing a kind of frontier. And if you establish a frontier, you're going to get a Wild West. And if you get a Wild West, you're going to get gunslingers going into it. And, you know, you get the fraud, you get the reckless behavior. And that in the long term actually is not sustainable. It's very corrosive and it does a lot of damage.
And Ireland had plenty of all that, says Fintan O'Toole. Fintan, lots of callers have been waiting. Let's go to Montreal, Canada. Anthony, you're on the air with Fintan O'Toole.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Hello. Fintan.
Hi, Anthony.
It seems to me, Fintan, that this whole crisis is a horrendous failure of government. We could all... I'm an Irish national and, you know, I'm in frequent touch with my family in Ireland. In my little town in Mayo, my little hometown in Mayo, in 2006, people were buying property, like you said, in Romania. And friends of mine told me that a lot of people in the West were, well, they would have one house and then they'd buy two other houses and they would pay nothing towards the mortgage. They would just be simply paying the interest on the mortgage. Now, that's a recipe for disaster. And also, could you comment on this? The children's allowances going to Poland and Romania and these countries.
You mean as charity? As charity, Anthony? Is that what you mean?
No, not as charity. A lot of tradesmen during the boom, Tom, and they were tremendous tradesmen, came from countries like Poland and Latvia.
Oh, sucking in all that labor to Ireland. Our time's growing short, but let us pick it up. Fintan, what do you say to Anthony's views?
Well, I think, first of all, on Anthony's main point about government, I think he's absolutely right. You know, the basic idea of government should be that, you know, government economic policy should be what we call counter-cyclical, you know, so that it should work against the grain. So if there's a big boom going on, government should be cooling it down, and then it should have some money in reserve to be able to pump into the economy when things slow. Now, we got caught up with the delusion, which wasn't unique to Ireland again, but we had a particularly concentrated version of it, that boom and bust was over, the good times were here forever. So the economic policy of the Irish government, I think their main economic advisor must have been Lauren Bacall in To Have and Have Not, where she's asked, you know, how do you whistle? Just pucker up your lips and blow, you know. So you got a bubble, what do? You blow into it and you make it bigger and bigger and bigger. So there were huge tax incentives for people to keep building. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. So most of these property developers and builders were actually ended up paying no tax. They were being given tax incentives to keep building, even when it was completely unnecessary. Now, in terms of the welfare question, I should say that a lot of this was, I have no problem with it at all. I mean, you had workers who were coming here from Central Europe and they were working in Ireland.
There was great demand in that booming economy.
There was great demand, absolutely. Now, there was a certain irony in that a lot of them were building the houses for the next wave of immigrant workers to come in and live in.
Yes.
You know, it sort of did become a bit crazy, but they were fantastic people. They were great, great workers. And some of them were getting child welfare payments for their kids back home. And now, I had no problem with that so long as those people were paying taxes, which actually the majority of them were. Now, that kind of system is open to abuse, but actually the majority of the people actually who came to work were, they reminded me very much of Irish people who went to the United States in the 1950s, 1960s. You know, they really wanted to work and they really wanted to improve themselves, and they were very concerned with their own families back home, and I think that kind of ambition, you know, the Irish are the last people who should ever complain about it.
You say that Ireland has paid a price for skipping modernity. And you've touched on that, but I wish you'd go more directly at it. And you also say that you need a kind of second republic, a kind of different rebirth. We've just got a couple of minutes, but those are big themes. Pick them up if you would.
They are, sure, yeah. Well, one of the things that's different about Ireland, actually, and it really only occurred to me in terms of writing this book, you know, that Ireland missed out on the Second World War. Now, I know a lot of people think, well, that's pretty good for you, isn't it? You know, the Second World War was horrific, and of course it was absolutely horrific, but Ireland was neutral and stayed out of that. But as a result of that, it also missed out on something that happened in the rest of Europe after the Second World War, which is after the Second World War, everybody said, you know, we have made a terrible disaster of democracy. It's reached a point of absolute barbarism. Therefore, we've got to rebuild. We've got to have a civic morality. We've got to have values. We've got to have institutions which actually make sure that government works really well. And Ireland didn't go through any of that. You know, we sort of got our democracy established in a very difficult way in the 1920s, and we really stopped there. And as a result of that, we never really got this idea that, you know, in order not to have governments that fall apart, you actually have to construct a whole political culture in which people are active citizens, in which they're really engaged with the process of democracy, and in which they actually can look to institutions that have a proper balance, that do their jobs, where you've got a parliament that really kind of scrutinizes what a government is doing. We didn't really do any of that stuff. And again, this might seem very abstract, but you really pay a price for that when you get into a period when you've got a great opportunity. If you don't know what you're doing, you're not going to really capitalize on those opportunities. And when there's a kind of recklessness going on, there's not the institution to say stop. Now, the important thing now is that In the circumstance where we are, I think maybe the message is getting across that we almost have to start from scratch. It's like saying, you know, we started in 1922, maybe we had a false start. Things have fallen apart to such an extent that the opportunity now exists really to say, okay, this democracy, this really thriving democracy that we didn't have and that we paid a price for not having, now is the time to build it.
Are you alone in that? Are you the gadfly out on a wing in a prayer, Fintan? Or with Ship of Fools, when people in Ireland read it, do they nod along with you and say, yes, Fintan, you're onto it, or you're right?
I'm in a slightly surreal situation, Tom, because I'm becoming popular, you know?
With that message.
I wrote a book in 2002 called After the Ball, saying like the Irish boom is over and we have to deal with that, you know. And then of course this other boom happened, and nobody wanted to listen. But now actually people genuinely are engaging and talking about this sort of stuff, and that's the one thing that makes me kind of hopeful.
Well, it's a great window into what happened in Ireland, the up and the down, and maybe what faces the country next. It's been great having you with us this hour. Fintan O'Toole is author of Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. Fintan O'Toole in Dublin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Go out with a little bit of Enya, Ireland's best-selling solo artist, this all the way back to 1995. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us.